It's 1942. Boston's swanky Coconut Grove Club is packed. In the basement, also known as the Melody Lounge, young people are partying away their World War II blues. The place is decorated to look like a tropical paradise. Thick coconut trees stand beside the tables, and pale blue streams of cloth create a false sky on the ceiling. Just after 10 p.m., flames shoot up one of the fake trees. Waiters rush to pull down the tree and put out the fire, but it's too late. The flames have spread across the room. People run to the narrow staircase, the only way to escape the growing blaze. The events of the next 10 minutes will forever change the city of Boston and impact hotels, restaurants, and bars around the world. I'm Les Stroud. I've survived some of the deadliest environments on Earth, but there are some things that even I might not walk away from. This is Deadly Disasters. Today, the Coconut Grove Fire. November 28, 1942. 41,000 college football fans jam into Boston's Fenway Park. The hometown Boston College Eagles are the best team in football. They've dominated all eight of their games and lead the country in both offense and defense. If they can win this game, they're off to the Orange Bowl. The Eagles are playing the Holy Cross Crusaders from nearby Worcester. The schools are only 41 miles apart, so fans from both teams are in the stands. The gap in ability, however, is huge. Holy Cross has lost as many games as they've won. This looks like it's going to be a blowout. The Eagles are so sure of the win, they've already planned a victory party that night at one of Boston's hottest clubs, the Coconut Grove. 17-year-old Pauline Brooks cheers from the stands bundled in a winter coat, but warm with excitement. This is a big day for her. Her boyfriend is the captain of the Boston College Eagles team. As Pauline belts out enthusiastic cheers, she's already looking past the game. When the home team wins, which everyone expects to happen, she'll get to go to the Coconut Grove for the first time.
I had gotten permission from my father to go, and I'd always wanted to see what it was like inside. My father was very strict in bringing us up, and I was not 18, so he had to agree.
Before Pauline gets to party, Boston College has to actually win the game. But the Holy Cross players don't seem to understand that they're 14-1 underdogs. 5 minutes into the game, the Crusaders run the ball into the end zone for the first points of the day. The Holy Cross fans erupt. Surely this was just a fluke touchdown, and Boston College would respond. Not a chance. The Crusaders never trail in the game. The underdogs score 10 more touchdowns to trounce mighty Boston College in the rivalry's most legendary contest. ...22-year-old Holy Cross fan Don Gribbins was in the stands for this historic victory.
The Holy Cross created the biggest upset in the history of athletics by defeating BC a score of 55-12.
Don and his friend from Worcester, 24-year-old Tommy Sheehan, both dark-haired and handsome, need a place to celebrate. Fortunately, someone from Boston College canceled their reservations at the Coconut Grove, so there's plenty of room for out-of-town fans to whoop it up. Tommy picks up the news from fellow Holy Cross fans.
After the game, we heard a lot of the crowd was going to the Coconut Grove. So Don and I, after a while, we got something to eat, and we hired a cab, and we went to the Coconut Grove.
Don has something else to celebrate.
I decided that I wanted something a little different, and I took the examination for the Worcester Fire Department. So I got appointed in November 4th of 1942.
Don and Tommy arrive at the club for a night of partying with their new best friends from the football game. The Coconut Grove has been a fixture in Boston since 1927. It's the place to be. The concrete and brick storefront is nothing special from the outside. It looks like a lot of the other buildings on the block. The building used to be a garage and warehouse, but had been converted to a speakeasy in 1927. Now it's owned by Barney Wolanski. He's not here tonight, though. Wolanski is resting in the Massachusetts General Hospital, recovering from a recent heart attack. Don and Tommy squeeze through the single revolving door on the main floor, the only way in from the front of the building. The interior is decorated in a tropical theme. The pillars are made to look like palm trees. Don and Tommy work their way through the well-dressed crowd. Everyone's in suits and party dresses. Smoke hangs in the air as the drinks flow. All of Don and Tommy's needs can be met here. The place is divided into a few big boxy rooms, joined by single doorways and the occasional tight hallway. As soon as they enter, they find a cocktail bar, the Caricature Lounge. Just past that is a dining room with a big dance floor in the middle, in front of a stage. If the friends can get past the stage, a slim hallway will take them to a lounge that just opened a few weeks ago. It has a back entrance that leads to the street. The new Broadway lounge has a long bar and a small seating area. Downstairs, there's a piano bar called the Melody Lounge. Guests can get to it through a small stairwell near the revolving door in the front of the building. It's intimate and dimly lit. Artificial palm trees and sky blue fabric hanging from the ceiling give it the feel of a tropical paradise. There are a lot of options for the happy football fans, if they can get to them. The place is filled to the brim, standing room only. Hollywood cowboy Buck Jones is up on the VIP terrace, getting more than a few stares. Jones is in town to raise a few bucks for war bonds. The party keeps growing as the night goes on. By 10 p.m., the staff has trouble getting through the crowd to deliver food and drinks. The legal capacity for the club is 460 people, but there are at least 1,000 people here. It's so crowded, Don can't reach his friends downstairs.
So we met the group from Worcester, and we tried to get into where they were seated, the Melody Lounge, and we could. There was no room there.
The only way down to the Melody Lounge is through the stairs by the revolving door in front. But even if Don and Tommy could get down the stairs, there's no way they could get into the room. It was built to hold 100 people, and there are at least twice that many in there now. One of the customers taking in the tropical vibes is Iria Finn. She's celebrating her 21st birthday with friends.
We went there about 9:30, and we went into the Melody Lounge, and we sat directly under the palm tree. where it all started.
Iria is enjoying her drink when she looks across to the next table. A soldier is cozying up to a young woman. He reaches above them and loosens a light bulb. The light goes out, and with that little twist, the couple gets some privacy. Stanley Tomaszewski is a 16-year-old busboy. He notices the soldier's maneuver and tells one of the bartenders. It's 10 minutes after 10. Historian John Deddy recounts the conversation at the bar.
He was told by the bartender to go over and re-screw in a light bulb that had been unscrewed by a patron who wanted a little more privacy for his time with his girlfriend. The light bulb happened to be in one of the coconut husks that was on the palm tree. At first he couldn't find the bulb, so he lit a match and held it up about 10 inches now below the palm tree, saw the coconut husk there with a little 7.5-watt light bulb in it. Blew the match out, tightened the bulb, stepped down, put the match on the floor, stepped on it, left.
The busboy heads back to the bar. As he walks away, customers see an orange flame appear in the paper leaves of the palm tree. Flames shoot down the wooden trunk. The staff leap into action. They try to pull the tree away from the ceiling fabric. Some spray it with seltzer bottles. They're too late. Fire explodes across the ceiling. It travels with astounding speed. The cloth on the ceiling is consumed in moments. Customers see the fire spreading across the room. They run to the only exit they know, the narrow stairs to the main floor, which is only 4 feet wide. The frightened crowd reaches the top of the stairs. They try to escape through an emergency exit. The door is bolted shut. Behind the people pressed up against the door, a crowd surges forward. There is nowhere to go. Back in the Melody Lounge, the tropical decorations go up in flames. A ball of fire rushes across the ceiling towards the stairwell. The oxygen in the stairwell ignites. The flames burst up to the main floor. Upstairs, in the main dining room, customers wait for the floor show to begin, unaware of the danger. Suddenly, there's a commotion near the front door. It sounds like someone is shouting, "Fight!" Then a thick cloud of black smoke pours into the main dining room. That's when customers realize what is actually being
Fire!
Yelled.
Fire!
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 Flames race across the cloth-covered ceiling. They spread to the walls. The main floor fills with smoke and fire. Customers and staff rush to a set of double emergency doors at the back of the club. They pull at the door handles. But the doors are locked. Then the lights go out. Historian John Deddy describes the scene.
And all of a sudden the place is in pitch darkness. Even if they knew that there was a door somewhere, there was no indication of it.
The fire rushes down the corridor from the dining room into the barroom that just opened up a few weeks earlier, the New Broadway Lounge. Don Gribbins and Tommy Sheehan are inside this brand new part of the club. They're chatting with 17-year-old singer Dottie Miles. She's just about to begin her set.
And the singer was taking requests for songs, and we asked her to play the Holy Cross Victory song. Very shortly after that, we heard this tipping over of tables and screaming and hollering.
Tommy looks around for the cause of the outburst.
And all of a sudden, we could smell smoke. And the next thing we knew, on the right-hand side of the bar, a big blast of flame come out through the walls. And everybody got excited and started to jump out of their tables and seats. And
Don tries to get away from the flames as fast as he can.
It was just mass confusion. There was no heroics there. With everybody for themselves.
Unfortunately for the customers, there were few exits and a whole lot of fire. It was the perfect recipe for a deadly disaster. November 28, 1942. At approximately 10:15 p.m., the Boston City Fire Department receives a call. There's a fire in the entertainment district. But there's already a fire crew close to the scene. They're putting out a blaze in a parked car close to the Coconut Grove. The car fire is extinguished and the crew packs up. They're about to head back to the station when they hear screams from a block away. The police are close by too. Detective Elmer Brooks and his partner are parked near a police call box. Brooks's daughter, Pauline Peck, talks about that moment.
And they were just sort of talking, and they were talking actually about the BC Holy Cross game. There was a flashing light on the call box near them. So he called it and they said, "Brooks, it's the Coconut Grove, it's on fire." When my father and his partner got there, the father said it was like Dante's Inferno. It was a scene out of hell.
Officer Brooks is stunned, and not just at the size of the blaze. Brooks's daughter, Pauline, is dating the Boston College quarterback. Officer Brooks had given her permission to go to the victory party at the Coconut Grove.
And my father thought that I was there.
Firefighter Charles Kenny Sr. and his team arrive on the scene, desperate to get inside. But they're horrified by what they see through the revolving glass door. His son, Charles Jr., hears the same story over and over from his father's colleagues.
They told me of what actions they took. They said, "Geez, Charlie, if only we could have gotten in there."
The revolving door isn't revolving. It's jammed shut. Charred bodies are blocking it and preventing a panicked crowd of people from getting out of the burning building. Iria Finn, who has been downstairs celebrating her 21st birthday at the Melody Lounge, made it upstairs and has avoided the flames so far, but her life is still in jeopardy.
There was a mob scene, everybody heading for the revolving doors. So I hung on to the coattails of this fellow, Bill. Well, I'll follow him and he'll pull me through here. And he elbowed me as if to say, "Look, everybody for themselves here."
Inside the Broadway lounge, flames consume the room. Don Gribbins and Tommy Sheehan are trapped. Don's training as a firefighter kicks in.
Always lay as close to the floor as you can, because that's where, if there's any air in the room at all, you're going to find them that close to the floor. And I said, "Tommy, let's go towards that room." Somewhere along the line, Tommy got lost in the shuffle.
Tommy can't find his friend Don in the darkness and thick smoke.
It started to get black. Everybody stood screaming. You could hear the women screaming all over, the men yelling, "Let's get to the door, let's get to the door."
Don is looking for an exit. Instead, he finds a grisly sight.
So I proceeded along the floor until I got to a point where I could see that the door was, because the bodies were piled up there probably 5 or 6 deep.
Don also finds some hope. The crowd is able to force open the door to the vestibule. He makes his move.
I got to sit up quick, took a lunge, and I got over the body and I fell out into the street.
Don runs to a nearby fire truck and grabs an axe. He smashes the axe through some block glass on the side of the building. Some pedestrians run over to help.
Once we got one loose, we allowed some air to get in there. And those who were at the door or near the door, they had any life left in them at all, went for that opening.
Don's friend Tommy is still inside. He's in danger. His face starts to blister. Something hits the back of his head, and he falls to the floor. The fire continues to rage in the main dining room. Customers and staff are trapped against the closed double doors in the back of the club. The frightened people finally break them open. The crowd rushes into the street, but fresh oxygen rushes into the club. The flames jump towards the new fuel and explode in a giant blast near the exit. Firefighter Charles Kenny Sr. tries to help. Kenny is outside the double doors when the explosion hits, as his son Charles Jr. explains.
My dad went down Shawmut Street, and when he hit that double door, people were trying to pour out of it. And as he stepped in, what he beheld was a pile of humanity about 5 feet high, 6 feet high, 50, 60, 70 bodies. And some alive, some already dead.
The scene is just as disturbing at the front entrance. Police officer Elmer Brooks is helping firefighters clear bodies. His daughter Pauline recounts the story.
He was trying to help pull bodies out from the revolving door because they were just stacked up like cordwood there. The door was jammed, and the arms and legs would come off in his hands at times.
Brooks is looking for one person in the pile of bodies.
He was constantly looking at faces because he kept praying that I wasn't there. You know, he kept thinking, "My God, please don't let her be there."
His search is desperate. Brooks sees charred body after charred body, but he can't find his daughter among the living or the dead.
If you have ever wanted to make your home feel safer, there's no better time than now. This week, our friends at Simply Safe are giving Deadly Disasters listeners 40% off their award-winning home security. Simply Safe has everything you need to make your home safe. Indoor and outdoor cameras, comprehensive sensors, all monitored around the clock by trained professionals who send help the instant you need it. Simply Safe was even named Best Home Security System of 2021 by U.S. News and World Report. You can customize a system for your home easily online in minutes and even get free custom recommendations from SimpliSafe. These are SimpliSafe's biggest discounts of the year. You can get a complete home security system starting at just over $100. There are no long-term contracts or commitments. It's a really easy way to start feeling a bit more peace of mind. So take advantage of SimpliSafe's holiday sale and get 40% off your new home security system by visiting simplisafe.com/deadly. Again, that's simplisafe.com/deadly for 40% off your entire system. What are you waiting for? This offer ends soon.
It's 11 p.m. at Boston's Coconut Grove. A fire has torn through the popular club, killing trapped customers. The blaze is under control now, and firefighters are finally able to enter the burned husk of a building. They find over 100 bodies piled on top of each other by the entrance to the Broadway Lounge. More burned corpses are in the corridor leading to the main dining room. Firefighter Charles Kenny Sr. starts lifting bodies, looking for any survivors. Under a pile of burnt corpses, he finds singer Dottie Miles. Her face and hands are burned, but she's alive. Tommy Sheehan stirs on the floor. When he collapsed, other people fell on top of him. He was protected from the fire by their blackened, burnt bodies. Tommy's alive, but is told he doesn't look too good.
Somebody grabbed me and said, "You better go to the hospital, you're all burned." And the next thing I knew, paramedics must have picked me up and brought me to Boston City Hospital.
Firefighters find more bodies in the main floor supper club. On the VIP terrace, Hollywood star Buck Jones is alive, barely. Firefighters explore the narrow stairway down to the Melody Lounge in the basement. They find the burnt corpses in piles 2 to 3 bodies high. The emergency fire door that could have taken victims to safety is double bolted shut. Their fate was sealed by a terrible management decision, as Charles Kenny Jr. explains.
Rather than having someone sneak out without paying a bill, some of the doors were bolted, others were locked. The only exit that most people knew was the way they came in.
Ira Finn managed to escape the death trap in the stairwell. She talks about how she was found.
Somehow, it's confusing after that, but I know somebody, firemen, pulled me out. And I'm sitting there with no shoes on and no coat or anything. And then a fireman came there and got me and took me to my girlfriend's house, and I could hear the sirens all night.
Detective Brooks searches the devastated club for his daughter. He can't find her anywhere. Brooks finally goes home and walks in the front door. That's when he sees his daughter, Pauline.
He couldn't talk. He just opened his arms and I walked into them, and he never said a word. I could see his eyes. I mean, you could see pain reflected in them and so forth.
The death count grows as the club is emptied. The final total is 492. The youngest victim, 15. Movie cowboy Buck Jones is among them. He dies in the hospital 2 days after the fire. Singer Dottie Miles has burns over 50% of her body, but she survives. The attention turns from the victims and survivors to the cause of the fire. Investigations are launched by both the state and county district attorneys. A public inquest is held too. At first, the blame is aimed at busboy Stanley Tomaszewski. The match he lit to examine the light bulb is thought to be the cause of the blaze. Charles Kenny Jr. thinks Stanley was judged too soon.
He was, from my point of view, the major victim of the Coconut Grove fire, because he lived under the mantle of having been called murderer and of having actually started the Coconut Grove fire.
But the young busboy is not to blame. The fire had already begun behind the wall of the Melody Lounge before Stanley lit his match. Historian John Deddy discusses the fire's origin.
In point of fact, and this was later determined to be the case, what actually started the fire was a big short circuit in an overfuse line behind the false wall.
The fire spread quickly because of an air conditioner in the Melody Lounge. It didn't use Freon. This air conditioner used methyl chloride, a much more volatile substance. Charles Kenny Jr. explains.
In essence, the initial accelerant that blew that fire to glory right away was methyl chloride escaping from that condenser compressor. The whole catastrophe happened in somewhere between 8 and 10 minutes.
When all the investigations are finished, the blame for the catastrophic fire falls on club owner Barney Wolanski, who is recovering from his heart attack at Massachusetts General Hospital while victims of his negligence were being treated just a few floors below. He's sentenced to 12 to 15 years for manslaughter and conspiracy to violate building laws. He serves 2.5 years and then is pardoned because of an illness. He dies a few months later. The fire at the Coconut Grove is a turning point in public safety. The Boston Fire Department recommends installing sprinkler systems in public places, clearly marking exit doors, and installing more than one avenue of escape. The report changes fire regulations across North America. Other safety measures are implemented too. Hinged doors are now required beside revolving doors. This is a direct result of the bodies piled near the front entrance to the club. Local hospitals that treated the victims also changed their procedures on how burn victims are cared for. At Boston City Hospital, the burn victims were treated with dyes and tannic acid. That was the prevalent method at the time. 30% of those patients died. Across town, at Massachusetts General Hospital, a new method was used. Burns were covered with gauze and petroleum jelly. They also used skin grafts. All of their patients recovered. The methods employed at Massachusetts General Hospital are later used to treat soldiers wounded in the war. The survivors of the fire recovered, but they never forgot how close they came to death that night in 1942. Pauline Peck says her father changed his habits at home.
Although he and my mother owned 3 or more homes in succession, all had fireplaces. My father would never let a fire be lit. Not even in the winter, not at holiday time, Christmas or whatever. He never allowed a fire. So it did impact him quite a great deal. I think I appreciated everything a little more fully, knowing that I might not have ever been. So I'm very grateful that it wasn't my time. I didn't go. God or the hand of Providence stopped me from going.
Don Gribbins made the most of the life he was given.
I thank God that I was able to come out and live another day and raise 8 children and 27 grandchildren. So I was put on this earth for something, or I kept on this earth.
Almost 500 people were denied the chance for a life as full as Don's. Perhaps there is some consolation in knowing their deaths helped make the world a safer place. In Boston, Massachusetts, the night of November 28, 1942, was always going to be a night to remember. But fate would ensure that it's remembered for all the wrong reasons. This episode of Deadly Disasters was produced by Ajit Parkal and Miklas Perlis for Storios. Adapted for audio by Craig Colby. And sound designed and mixed by Brian Eimer at Images and Sound. This podcast is adapted from the television series Disasters of the Century. Our executive producer is Ron Getz, and our supervising producer is Robert Lockman. Deadly Disasters is a production of Partners in Motion. I'm Les Stroud.